I'm Bob Anderson, and I'll chair this meeting. The title of the talk is From the Absolute to the Individual, Person and Premortal Existence in 19th Century Mormonism and Romanticism, and will be given by James McLaughlin. Jim is a professor of philosophy and religion at Western Carolina University. He holds a BA from BYU, MA in European History from Indiana University, and PhD from the University of Toronto. He studied philosophy at the University of Paris. He was a visiting scholar at the Center for Process Studies at Claremont School of Theology. He is co-chair of the Mormon Studies Consultation at the American Academy of Religion, past president of the Society of Mormon Philosophy and Theology, and an editor of Element, the Journal of Society of Mormon Philosophy and Theology. He is the author and editor of books and articles, and a co-editor of Discourses in Mormon Theology, and has a chapter in a book on Mormonism and Problems of Evil. The discussant will be Dan Weatherspoon. He served in the Washington-Seattle mission in 1983 and 4, taught missionaries at the Missionary Training Center. He has a BA in philosophy, minor in classical civilizations from BYU, an MA from Arizona State University in religious studies, and a PhD in religion from the Claremont School, Graduate School. So we'll turn the time over to Jim and let us overwhelm us.
If you want to move up, that'd be okay. Well, gee, everybody ought to introduce themselves. Okay, well, it's the absolute, the individual, personal and premortal existence in Mormonism and Romanticism. You guys all recognize this guy, probably. Anybody not recognize?
No man knows him.
This is F.W.J. Schelling, German Romantic philosopher who is difficult to read. This is a guy named Jakob Berma. He was a 17th century German mystic, and of whom Aldous Huxley once wrote, "Reading Berma is like going to a picnic. He brings the words, and you bring the meaning." So, this guy is the easiest to read of the bunch. Nikolai Berdyaev, who's just a crazy Russian guy. Okay, but this meeting is also a recruitment session for the Society of Mormon Philosophy and Theology. We're joint sponsoring it with the Sunstone folks. Yeah, that's where this is, right? Sunstone. Okay. So here it is. You can join up, and you can have fun with other strange people who are interested in these kind of things. Here's the website, www.smpt.org, really easy to remember. And we have a journal. This is the journal Element. It's the journal of the Society of, well, I'm not going to read the name again. But it's that woman back there. Raise your hand. Yeah. This is my wife, Carrie. Carrie and I have just taken over editorship of the journal from Brian Birch at UVU.
I was there yesterday, and there was an actual passing of a steak knife.
Yeah. So, if you go to the website, there's a lot of this stuff on online that you can read. There's good stuff in there. I just like this guy, so I put his picture up there. That's William Chamberlain. He's the... was the first Mormon to do formal studies of philosophy. But I guess we really ought to get into this. And I'm not going to read all these quotes. I've got hundreds of quotes up here. But there's a famous, less famous book by Mark Twain called The Mysterious Stranger. Anybody ever read this book? If you want to be thoroughly depressed, this is the Mark Twain for you. matter of fact, this guy here, that's from a film by Will Vinton. Remember the California Raisins claymation?
Uh-huh.
He did a film in the 80s called The Adventures of Mark Twain, where he had the light Mark Twain and the dark Mark Twain, because, you know, Mark Twain could be incredibly depressing when he wanted to. And he wrote this book called The Mysterious Stranger, and I think it has the most how would you say, the most biting critique of theism and belief in God at the end of this that I've ever read. I remember reading it in high school and being depressed for a month. Because it's kind of like, no good deed goes unpunished. And that's, Werner Herzog once did a film called The Enigma of Caspar Hauser. Every man for himself and God against all. And that's basically this book. Okay? But let me just read something here. Strange. The guy is just realizing that he's made up this whole God thing. Strange that you would not have suspected years ago, centuries ago, ages ago, eons ago, for you have existed. Got lights there, I can't. Companionless. I'm going to read it off of here. Okay. Companionless through all eternity. Strange indeed that you should not have suspected that your universe and its content were only dreams, visions, fictions. Strange because they are so frankly and hysterically insane. Like all dreams, a God who could make children, good children as easy as bad, yet preferred to make bad ones, who could have made every one of them happy, yet never made a single happy one, who made them all prize their bitter life, yet stingily cut it short, who gave his angels eternal happiness unearned, yet required his other children to earn it, who gave his angels painless lives, yet cursed his other children with biting miseries and maladies of mind and body, who mouthed justice and invented hell, who mouths mercy and invented hell, mouths golden rules and forgiveness multiplied 70 times 7 and invented hell, who mouths morals to other people and has none himself, who frowns upon crimes yet commits them all, who created man without invitation. This is pretty, you know, heavy stuff. And then tries to shuttle the responsibility of man's acts upon man instead of honorably placing it where it belongs, upon himself. And yet, and finally, with altogether divine obtuseness, invites this poor abused slave to worship him. I'll skip the last part, but you get the idea. Okay, this is Mark Twain's reaction against the Calvinism of his youth, right? Now, what I want to do in this paper is talk about, you know, if you take a certain view of God, I think Twain's critique at work are almost unavoidable. And there are a lot of smart people who would disagree with me on that. But there are other views of God, and I think that early Mormonism, you know, especially in things like King Follett, but if you follow through with Brigham Young and others, you get a very different view of God, I think in the Book of Mormon too, actually, than this kind of all-powerful, omnipotent, omnipresent God of theism. And that's part of what I'm going to talk about in my paper. This guy, Edgar Sheffield Brightman, anybody remember a guy named Sterling McMurrin? Okay. McMurrin was not one himself, but he studied a lot with people called personalists. His guy down at Southern California was a guy named Ralph Tyler Fluellen. But this Brightman was a part of that group. He was a Boston. And if you read Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion, this guy's name pops up a lot, which it never pops up anywhere else anymore. But the other big thing about him, this guy was Martin Luther King's mentor. King's theology was kind of based on Brightman. But Brightman wrote this really interesting book called The Problem of God, and he said in it, it has a triple meaning for the title of the book, that God is a problem for us, that we are a problem to him, and strange as it may sound, God is a problem to himself. It's a pretty provocative statement. We want to figure out what it means. But the key of this paper, actually, is my response to a book by a friend of mine. I really think this is a great book, and you should read it. So everything mean that I'm going to say about it today, just realize that it's just about, like, 40 pages in the middle that I didn't agree with. But the rest of it was great. Okay. So When Souls Had Wings, which is Premortal Existence in Western Thought by Terrell Givens. Now, what Terrell talks about is how one way of dealing with the problem of evil, why do bad things happen to good people, was the idea of preexistence. And there's various ways that people have done this. I mean, B.H. Roberts, you know, a popular one among Mormons often was, well, if bad things happen to you here, you obviously were one of the less valiant folks up there. Okay? Or, you know, and then it's remarkable how much this is like certain things in Hinduism. If you read this is the... this is the most boring Hindu book, called The Laws of Manu, but it's also incredibly fun because it tells you exactly what will happen to you in the next life if you screw up in this one. For example, a Brahmana who has fallen off his duty and becomes a Ukka Mukha Preta, a comet mouth ghost who feeds on what has been vomited. And a Kshatriya, or a warrior, or a Kataputatana, who becomes a false stinking ghost who eats impure substances and corpses. This is my favorite one, though. A Vasya, who has fallen off with his duty, becomes a, I'm not even going to try to read that, that's a pus-eating ghost that sees out its anus. Okay, so pre-existence can explain a lot of stuff. Okay. But as Terrell points out, in early Christianity, pre-existence was actually used as a way to explain why bad things happen to certain people. Matter of fact, here's a quote from Aeneas of Gaza, who said, if we deny the pre-existence of souls, how is it possible for the wicked to prosper and the righteous ones to be idle in idle circumstances? How can we accept the fact that people are born blind, and some die immediately after they are born, and others reach very old age? So you see, this was a way of dealing with the problem of evil, which is what Mark Twain's trying to deal with. Now, it didn't win out. If you ask the average Christian, do you believe in the pre-existence of souls, they would say, absolutely not. This guy is won out, St. Augustine. And here's a nice, I won't read this whole thing, but he's sitting down, he's thinking about the problem of evil. Augustine is one of the most profound thinkers on the problem of evil that Christianity has produced. Unfortunately, from a more important view, I think he's absolutely wrong about just about everything. Okay? I once had a Russian Orthodox professor of mine said, Augustine just screwed up the West completely. Okay? Anyway, so, but notice what he's talking about here. He says, what is promised to us is a vision of beauty. And that vision of beauty is going to solve all these problems here. And therefore, it is inevitable that all things come into being in accordance with order, and nevertheless, God is not petitioned in vain. God knows everything that's going to happen. He's painted this great, beautiful painting, and you know, if you could just, from a distance, look at it, you would see it all works. You just happen to be in a dark spot, okay, if bad things are happening too. This is probably the gayest picture I've ever seen. But it's a wonderful thing. What do you think it's of? Anybody? How many think it's Jesus and the 12 disciples? Could be, right? But it's actually Socrates and the young men who he teaches. This is by Jean Daville, who was a Belgian symbolist painter, and he painted this in 1898. It's a really interesting painting. It's in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. But I want to talk about Plato's idea of pre-existence, because this is one that Terrell talks a lot about in the book, and how it relates to inspiration and erotic desire. And interestingly enough, Plato, though he believes in predestination, is probably the key influence on Augustine. Who doesn't? But I won't go through this whole thing, but here's Plato at the end of his book, The Symposium, talking about the ultimate thing that we can get to is what mystics have come to call the beatific vision. That you could see all the beauty of things all together, okay? And you would see how everything fits. And there's a wonderful version of this that you all know, and that's Dante at the end of the Divine Comedy. You know, where he goes from hell through purgatory, and then finally he arrives at the beatific vision of God. There's him and Beatrice. Now, does anybody notice something here? This is Beatrice, right? Who's Beatrice? Remember? You know, the woman he loved. He finally runs into her in heaven. Is he looking at Beatrice? Uh-uh. They're both looking at God because they don't care about each other anymore. They fit into the whole of the, you know, the perfect union with God. And I could say a lot about this. You know, this is the idea from Augustine. From God's point of view, there is no evil. everything fits in its place. Like if we could have one of you volunteer to be Judas, you will burn in hell forever. But you burning in hell forever is actually good because you deserve that. And that fits into the total picture of, you know, Jesus and the crucifixion and everything. Okay. I hate to make light of Augustine because he's a bright guy, but he says, we are like people ignorant of a painting who complain that the colors are not beautiful everywhere in the picture, but the artist has laid the appropriate tint to every spot. How many of you read The Brothers Karamazov, by the way? Okay, the most famous part in there is Grand Inquisitor. What Ivan Karamazov is doing in there when he says, I don't accept this, is this is what he's attacking. I don't care if there's cosmic harmony. Children suffer. That can't be, you know, made up for in some cosmic harmony at the end. Okay, so that's the position Mark Twain in that first piece that we were looking at is complaining about. Now, one of the points that Terrell makes is that the idea of preexistence really goes back to Plato, but in Christian tradition goes back to this guy, Origen, who was a universalist, that everything comes from the mind of God. Okay, so we have a fall from the mind of God into matter, and then a return to God. Okay, everybody's going back, even Satan and Ivan Karamazov, whether they want to or not. Okay, so that's a universalist. Everybody makes it. Even there were Baptist universalists in the mountains in North Carolina where I'm from. They were called no-hellers. Life was so bad here that, you know, you couldn't send anybody to hell. Okay. So, but anyway, so. But I wanted to show you, Neoplatonism is, you know, picking up on Plato. The most famous philosopher here is Plotinus. But here's an example of Neoplatonism. It's, y'all recognize this as David. I can't do it because I don't look that good. But, question. If you were from Mars and you got a copy of the Bible and read the story of David and Goliath, would you figure that was David? No. I mean, you might figure it out, you know, if somebody told you because there's a rock in his hand. But this is the ideal human form. Michelangelo was a great Neoplatonic Christian Platonist. And so we have the ideal human form, imitating the ideals that exist in the mind of God up in heaven for eternity, and they're perfect. Unfortunately, we fall into matter. This is most of us, okay? And that corrupts us.
Okay. A lot of money to put us
There's Adonis.
Where did you get that?
The internet, you can find anything. Okay. So things get mixed with matter, and then, you know, we all go to hell. Okay. But we will return into the mind of God, into the perfection. But now, the big point I want to make here, though, is that in this Platonic vision, when we get back there, we will arrive back at a perfection that is changeless and eternal. Nothing that happened here ultimately matters. We fell, we've got to get back. Augustine is the same thing. This is where original sin comes from. We fell, we're separated from God. No, there is a happy fall in that Jesus shows up and gets us back, but all this crap that you go through here isn't worth it. Okay? And that's probably not completely fair, but I, you know, if I had an Augustinian in here, I would argue it with them. Okay. We get a different version of this starting in the 19th century. Well, actually starting in the 17th century with Berma, but it's the Romantics, and a lot of them are influenced by this guy Berma, who we'll talk about in a little bit. But you get a different version of the story. Once again, it's you start out in like an Eden, a idea of unity, innocence, but it's a unity without individuality, Adam and Eve in the garden. There's a fall into alienation and suffering. And then you... At the end, you come back, but you're better off than you were before. You have unity with individuality both. And there's two points in here, I guess, examples you could take. The Wizard of Oz. You know, you start out in Kansas, boring, black and white. You go to Oz, scary,
color though.
Okay. And it actually, in Baum's book, what happens in Oz is Dorothy learns to love. She learns not just to love Auntie Anne, she learns to love the Tin Man, the Cowardly Lion, and the Scarecrow. So the final unity is greater than the first unity. It's superior to it. And this guy, Jakob Berma, I'm going to bring the meaning, talks about the same thing here. He says, from the point of view of God and of humanity, what we start out with is unity, but it's not really anything. He says, there is neither friend nor foe, for it is the eternal good and nothing else, but that's boring. The one has nothing within itself which could possibly desire, neither does unity own itself. It is possible only in a state of duality. You can only get love, you can only get everything good that we experience in a state of duality. But then you can get everything bad we experience too. And if you, there's another quote from Berma here, but you can, this is going to come out in dialogue in the winter, supposedly, whatever that winter means. You could read it there if you'd like. But notice he talks about there's no joy, no perception, anything in this kind of unity. But if you read the Book of Mormon, you know, the famous passage, 2 Nephi chapter 2, 11 and 12, about the opposition in all things, this sounds awfully like what Berma is saying too. For it needs be that there is an opposition in all things. If not so, righteousness could not be brought to pass, neither wickedness, neither holiness nor misery, neither good nor bad. Wherefore, all things must need remain in a compound of one, having neither life nor death. Wherefore, there would be no purpose, no end of the creation. Wherefore, a thing must need destroy the wisdom of God, and also the power and the mercy and justice of God. Now, one of the things I've always found interesting is there are so many people who would claim that the Book of Mormon reflects a kind of Calvinist theology or a kind of, you know, different types of Christianity that go to the time. This is different. Okay, it's basically different. Now, maybe you can tie it like John Brooks tries to do to people like Berma and the Hermetic tradition, but this is a big difference. And one of the things, too, is the opposition is going to go all the way down by the time we get to the King Follett discourse. I think it's in the Book of Mormon, but I think it's even in God. He's just handling it better than we are. Okay. And so, you know, we realize that, you know, Adam fell, that men might be and men are, that might have joy. This is a really positive idea of the fall. But it's also a sense that suffering is just a part of existence, and God suffers along with us. And Berma says similar things here, even into a kingdom of joy, in order that nothing might be known in the something. That the nothing might be known in the something. So things split apart. And this is how you get knowledge, because you only can have knowledge in relation to something other than yourself. I mentioned that movie, The Enigma of Caspar Hauser, by Werner Herzog. One of the interesting things in that film is Caspar Hauser is locked in a closet for the first 20 years of his life. When he comes out, he has no language, right? They ask him what it was like in the closet. He says, I don't remember. He had no reference point, no other, nothing to think about. And so, you know, this is the idea of the opposition of all things. You need to have something to bounce off. The great Hindu philosopher Ramanuja said, in order for love to exist, there must be a lover and a beloved. Even for God. Now, the idea that comes out of this is that that there is something beyond the opposition, that unity that we start out with. But that's just pure potentiality. And the great philosopher Immanuel Kant called this the sublime. I tried that. This is a Thomas Moran painting of the Grand Canyon. Pretty cool, right? The sublime was that shatters all our categories. We are beings that when we look at something beautiful, we kind of frame it. But then there are these moments where we walk in, we see the, and we, this is the original meaning of the term awesome, where it shatters our categories. We can't, it's like, I remember when I was a little kid, he says there's a mathematical sublime, and I thought I'd learned all my numbers. I learned all my alphabet, I learned all my numbers because I could count to 100. And I remember a friend of mine saying, no, there are more numbers than 100. And I said, no, they just go to 100. And he said, 101, and I just went, oh. Wow. See, that's the sublime. Okay. That there is something beyond what we can fathom. And that's also going to be, you know, that opposition in all things, you know, we get back, that's also the source of human freedom. We can't be reduced to a set of ideas. And Schelling goes, well, let me do another Schelling first. Okay. Schelling actually says this. He says, this is the German philosopher picking up on Bermer. Says, this is the incomprehensible basis of reality of things, the irreducible remainder into which cannot be resolved, reasoned by the greatest extension, but always remains in the depths. And out of this, which is unreasonable, reason in the true sense is born. Now, I want you to see something here. We don't want to go back to this because it's nothing. Or no thing would be a better way to think of it. We want to get to this. So the fall is a fall up because we can do stuff. We can think about things. We can come to know things. And the biggest thing we can come to know is each other. And Schelling writes, God can only reveal himself in what is like him, in free beings, acting on their own. For those beings, there is no ground other than God, who are as God is. He speaks and they are there. Now, this is really an interesting statement. He speaks and they are there. It sounds like, you know, this is traditional Christianity, right? God speaks and the universe comes into existence. It's more serious than that. God speaks, and God comes into existence. Why? Because he has another to speak to. You think of something like Richard Bushman in the author's diary for Rough Stone Rolling, who's Kofod in the Cells, talks about this. You know, if you look at King Folloc, it's a council of God. It's that we are invited to participate in. It's this group, you know, in order to have consciousness, in order to be aware of something, there has to be others out there. There has to be language, there has to be dialogue, in order to be loved, there has to be a beloved. And I think this is the meaning of something like Alma 42:3-7. Just a 42:3-7, okay? I'm skipping some verses here. But where we're talking about the fall. It says, now we see that man had become as God, knowing good and evil. And lest he should put forth his hand and take of the tree of life and eat and live forever, the Lord God placed cherubim and a flaming sword, that he should not partake of the fruit. But look at this. And now ye see by this that our first parents were cut off both temporally and spiritually from the presence of the Lord. And thus we see they became subjects. They became individuals. They became people. It's like your little kids when they become teenagers and you can't stand them for a while, you know. But you still love them, but they're in rebellion. They're becoming individuals. To follow after their own will. And you can will good or you can will evil. So we move away from the self and toward love and freedom. I won't read this quote here. Well, I will, because you all know it, but this one from Schelling. This is the secret of love, that it unites such beings as could exist in itself, and nonetheless neither is nor can be without the other. And you know that this one often gets seen as a kind of Calvinist quote, but I don't think so. This is King Benjamin, the natural man is an enemy to God and has been since the beginning. We have a tendency as individuals, and if you read the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, you see this, to to want to make ourselves, to blow up like balloons, to want to make ourselves masters of the universe, to deny the fact that there are other people out there. Most famous example for us of this is probably Satan, but also Cain. Remember in Moses, he says, I am Master Mahan. I have learned the great secret that I can murder to get gain. Or think of the John Galt of the Book of Mormon. Korihor, who says, what you do, but what you gain by yourself is yours. You have no concern for anyone else. That's, and they call him the Antichrist. Okay? That's significant. Okay? Why? It's not because he's just going to be no Jesus. It's because he thinks what he's doing is completely antithetical to what Jesus is doing. Jean-Paul Sartre calls this the desire to be God that he thinks is in all of us. But there's a way back. We can submit to the Holy Spirit. We can submit to the other. We can, something beyond us. And if you remember right, just in the next chapter, who's the beyond us? It's that poor wayfaring grand man of grief who comes up to you and says, can I have a dime? And you say, no, you deserve what you got. And then Benjamin says, you've got to repent, brother. Okay? Because, you know, you're in there with all these other people. And of course, let me just end with this. This is going to end on a negative note, which is really bad that I'm going to do it that way. Okay, here's the famous lines from Moses chapter 5 where Cain is talking about when he kills Abel and says, I have learned the great secret. And this is a little passage from Berma's Six Theosophic Points that I love, where Berma says, what's hell? Hell is the place where you blame everyone else for your being there. That's what creates hell. That idea turns up again in Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky when Grushenka tells the story of the little onion. So I will end positive. There's a little peasant dies and goes up to heaven. And the peasant is about to go in. He says, is my mother up here? And St. Peter looks at the book and says, your mother was a really rotten person. You know, she's down in hell. I mean, she was never nice to anybody, ever. And the guy says, well, it won't be heaven without my mother. And he says, well, you've been such a good little peasant. We do have on record a moment where she threw an onion at a beggar. And we don't know if she was throwing the onion at the beggar because she was giving him an onion or she just wanted to get rid of him and was throwing an onion at him. So you take this onion, one of those little ones, right? You go down to hell, and if you can pull her out by this onion, she can come to heaven. He goes down there, runs down the hill with the little onion. He goes, Mom! Mom! They're all burning down there and being tormented by the demons and all that. Here, grab this onion. You can come out. So she grabs hold of the onion. He starts pulling her out of hell. And somebody sees her being pulled out of hell and he grabs onto her. Somebody else sees her. All hell is being lifted out by this little onion. And she turns around to the person behind her and says, this is mine! The onion snaps and they all fall back into hell. Okay. The message, I think, of the gospel and of these romantics is we're all in this together. Thanks a lot.
Dan, we'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. You did not deliver the paper that you gave me.
Well, it's pretty well the paper.
Yeah.
It's a better...
The way I was going to start today anyway is a tribute to my friend Jim McLaughlin.
The paper was 7,000 words long and would have taken 2 hours. Tried to shorten it. I said I shortened it 2 minutes.
Okay. We've known each other 15 years, and I should have known that you wouldn't read a paper. This is... It's accepted by Dialogue, so we'll be seeing it soon. It is extremely... beautifully written as far as philosophy and, you know, subtle but important things here. You kind of left out those critiques of Terrell that you said that you were going to give here and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
These are in here, and they're the product of...
I got carried away.
Jim, you've been wrestling with Schelling, Berma, Berdyaev, everybody since your dissertation, right? So was that 30 years? Or 20 years?
25
years. I guess this is you know, this is a beautiful soul and a wonderful teacher. You can see, you know, you come to Jim and it's always going to be this way, but he's a great scholar. And I guess having read this paper and kind of thinking he'd probably stick closer to it, and then he would offer the critiques that he does, and he would do it. I want the tenor of the response that I wanted to give was, because you're such a good scholar, and because you take this stuff so seriously, and I actually brought an example and a couple of free copies for anybody of your article that we did together in Sunstone. I mean, that you wrote, that I published when I was there. Because you've done this level of work, and you can take Terrell Gibbons and take those 40 pages and say, yeah, you get it, but you don't really get it. I guess I wanted to say, this stuff that you dealt with in this paper, between the difference between a Mormon conception of God who's in the mess, who's in the soup, who's in relationship, that's the Mormonism I love. But thanks to you and this kind of work that you can do and that you do, we're able to take it to this more public level. We're able to take it to this presentational level of you know, the person in the street. You're able to, and in fact, I brought this because just naturally, you can see he watches movies and he reads great literature, and he's always able to take pretty subtle, you know, Russian philosophy and German stuff here, and he's able to relate it to Groundhog Day, you know, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Adventures of Don Juan, and he's able to take these ideas, and we'll have seen them in a movie, or we'll have seen them in a novel, and we'll say, that protagonist made the right choice. Yes, it is better to love than to have a timeless eternity and stuff like that. I mean, maybe you're better than me. You could tell them quickly the end of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you remember that, Anne? You know, Chow Yun-Fat got poisoned, and Michelle Yao, who he's loved, you remember he's a Buddhist monk, and Michelle Yao, who he's loved all these years, is sitting there in front of him, and she says, and he says, I want to tell you something. She says, save your last breath that you can for your meditation so you can enter Nirvana. And don't waste your last breath. And say, I've wasted my whole life. I would rather, and he tells her how much he loves her, and he says, I would rather wander alone by your side as a hungry ghost than enter paradise without you. Great line. And, you know, if you've ever seen any of those Japanese horror films, The Grudge and stuff, you know what a hungry ghost is. It's not a happy meal. You know? And he says, you know, I would rather do that than experience Nirvana if I could be with you. And that's...
And we all recognize that as the powerful choice, right? And yet, when you take seriously the Calvinist, you know, God, Platonic God and what perfection is and stuff like that, you don't, you know, we need a Jim McLaughlin to help us see that we're seeing the stuff that people aren't doing. And yet when we're able to see the right choice being made, or obviously the better choice, so he uses Groundhog Day. You know, Bill Murray is immortal, finally commits to actually loving her instead of just to entertain himself by trying to seduce her. You know, he makes those choices and different ones. And I was actually thinking, you use Wings of Desire. That's subtitled, is it a French film?
That's a German.
German film. But City of Angels. I was actually thinking, when you were talking, as I was reading the paper, and the Beatrice and Dante, you know, looking at heaven instead of each other, I was thinking of the City of Angels, and they're able to hear music in the sunrise, you know, and that's what he basically said, I had to leave, but I would do it 100 times over, you know, to taste that pear, or to touch her hair, or to smell Meg Ryan's hair. And so she and Dennis, you know, the fall into relationality, the fall into mess, the fall into tragedy, the fall into pain, is just gorgeous, and you're so good at it. But I really did, I guess my whole thought today was to take something so elegant and then kind of do my best to, again, forgetting that you would give a fantastic praise like paper like this, but I guess I wanted to say, as an, I get, it's an aside, but it really is something else. I deal a lot with people who are leaving Mormonism, who have left Mormonism, who aren't sure if they can stay in Mormonism. You know, I do a podcast that's important and good, but lots of people write me with their struggles and things like that. And it always feels to me like they're leaving a Mormonism that isn't a robust version of itself. It's a caricature of Mormonism. It's the one that we're presenting to the world today, the one that, you know, it looks like it's just conservatism on steroids or whatever, or the Book of Mormon musical. You know, I'm not going to be total ass about it, but, you know, they think that they've somehow nailed some core bit about Mormonism. But this is the crap that we've got. You are preaching the way an Orson Pratt would just stand up and say, the absurdities of immaterialism. Jim is saying, well, in fact, there's a line you didn't give, but if one called such a being perfect, it would have to be the perfection of perfect vagueness, perfectly boring, perfectly empty. Jim is the kind of guy that would say that 100 years ago that we need to have said today. And I guess my true point was, he can back it up. You know, he lets us play offense because we know the defense is there. He has wrestled with this material. And if you ever want to say or feel compelled to say, you were not getting the difference. Even Terrell wasn't quite getting how radically different these players that you're playing with were from the Platonic, breaking out from the Neoplatonic tradition. No Jim has provided to us. So I don't even know if I want to do it anymore. I was going to kind of do a Don LaFontaine movie voiceover kind of version of your philosophy here, but I think you did it yourself, you know, with your animation and your smiles and stuff like that. But, you know, just to say, you know, instead of just, you know, in 1820, Joseph Smith, a young boy, you know, went into the woods and all this stuff, you know, we could do Joseph Smith, a young man, you know, feeling life deep within his guts, you know, studying the scripture, torn by his parents. We could really do the thing. You know, he goes in the woods and something happened. It kicked his butt. He went in there not knowing whether he wanted forgiveness of sins. He went in there not knowing what church to join. You know, something kicked his butt so much that he knew he was forgiven. You know, he didn't know if there was one God. He didn't know if there was two gods. But he knew that what he saw out there in religion didn't feel the way this experience felt, that said God loved radically, that God was with us in the thing or something. So I was just going to try to, I didn't practice it, but I wanted to just sort of give that feeling that this is the kind of stuff that I can't dismiss. This is stuff I love about Mormonism. And I thank you, I honor you. Read this when it comes out in dialogue. If you aren't a Sunstone subscriber, grab one of these. I also printed out one copy. But if you are, find this one. It's the 150th. It's on the website. Just go to the front page of the magazine one, scroll down, and you can download it. But this is his one, because that was the other point here. We did great, but I was going to say, if I had one word to it, I want more Joseph Smith. I mean, you can when you know the Mormonism, you kind of you're hearing it, but I wanted more of a tie-in, because he does a wonderful thing at the end about talking of, it kind of helps us settle that whole question, were we intelligences all along, or did God at some point take a dipper and put into spirit bodies? And he comes up with an elegant way, and maybe in Q&A, we have 15 minutes, so maybe that'll be a chance, something you can kind of make some of those later points, but because you gave such a better presentation, mine feels weird to have done it in this style. But that was really what I wanted to do, was to tell you I love this stuff. You are just the perfect combination of a scholar and somebody who gets it. And because of that, we're free to push it the way I want to see it pushed. I hate the Mormonism that's becoming boring, that isn't distinct. And thank you for really being the champion of this piece. So, thanks.
Thank you, Dan, and don't leave. We have more that have come, a little bit more, but now it's time for questions. And I'd like to ask each of you to come up with your questions so we get it good on the audio.
Uh, Just for clarification, we're talking about unity and duality.
Would you say who you are?
Oh, I'm Lee Smith.
Okay.
That scripture you quoted in 2 Nephi talks about you have to have opposition in all things, but it becomes a compound in one. It sounds like the paradox of both duality and unity, that God is very much involved in the world and in the suffering, but we handle differences in a way that unites us and honors and becomes unified. Would you expand on that a little bit?
I think that the kind of the term is eschatology here. That, you know, eschatology means study of the last things, where we're going, you know, Zion. That the unity at the end is superior to the unity at the beginning. The unity in Zion is superior to the unity in Eden. Because in Eden, you know, you're innocent, you haven't gone through all this stuff. It's like Dorothy in Oz, in Kansas. It's a wonderful description of Kansas at the beginning of Baum's book. You know, it's great in the movie, but everything's gray, nothing is alive. Salman Rushdie, in his commentary on the film, once said, think of what they named her. Her name is Dorothy Gale. She's like a tornado herself who comes smashing into the screen, demanding justice for her little dog, Toto. Okay? And that, you know, that's the conflict that's set up. But it's the, you know, it's through the conflict that we grow that love becomes possible, so that the final love, because what you're aiming at is unity. But it's a unity that is, you know, it's what's on the penny, e pluribus unum. It's a unity that retains diversity. And anybody who's in love knows the difference. If, like, how many of you had teddy bears when you were little? At a certain point, the teddy bear stops working. Because you realize the teddy bear is just you going, oh, you're wonderful. What is so wonderful about, you know, love, friendship, anything like that, is you have that other person who will tell you you're a jerk, but then at other times tell you, you know, you're wonderful. You know, it's politicians need, you know, more of that, I guess. But I think, does that respond to your question? But yeah. The unity, it's a conscious unity at the end. It's not just...
Sometimes, you know, in Buddhism you have the notions of duality and coming to unity, but you lose something if with just this divine unity. I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah, if we go back to just divine unity, yeah. And what's interesting, and this is going to sound terrible, but I wrote my dissertation on Jean-Paul Sartre and Nikolai Berdyaev, and the title of it was The Desire to Be God. And what Sartre thought was a basic characteristic of human beings. This is why Sartre's other famous line, hell is other people. Sounds like Burma, doesn't it? But it's that we all have these projects. We want to be somebody. Remember, I just watched On the Waterfront the other night, Marlon Brando. I want to be somebody. I could have been a contender. So what am I? I'm a bum. Okay? We want to be God. But that idea of being God is to control everything. It's not to have real relationships with real beings who can tell you you're wrong. And the Mormon idea of God seems to me to, okay, we'll give up omnipotence in the usual sense. You can't do everything you want because you're up against these other beings out there, and you've got to persuade them. And that's one of the answers, I think, to the way we look at the pre-existence. You know, there's the B.H. Roberts, we were persons forever. And then there's Bruce R. McConkie, we were the intelligence glop that God turned out, you know, the scooper scooped this out and got bad people.
I got more than you, though.
Yeah, some people got bad glop, you know? Okay. What you get here, and I go back and I read those early Joseph Smith things in Brigham Young, and I think it is more like this. God calls us into being. It's kind of like, you know, think about when you were a baby. You don't have many memories of that. But you're being called into becoming something by other people who are around you. God is calling us into being. Bushman describes this. He says, we're like little fish swimming in the sea, and the gods offer us something better. And we are called into being in relation to them, into multiplicity. But also the multiplicity that, you know, is the could lead us to the creation of Zion. And, you know, when is this going to happen? I don't know. God works on cowboy time. We'll get it done in 7 days, no matter how long it takes. Okay?
Well, that right there, there was another portion that, have you all heard of Brigham Young's take on what a son of perdition is and what outer darkness means?
Yeah.
So why don't you go ahead and
share
that. It's right on the heels of that. If God calls you into being, you can call yourself out of being.
Yeah, the Verma and Schelling do this too, and but it's in Brigham Young and it's in Rational Theology by Johnny Witzow, that the more you deny reality, which is relation to others, the less you are. Until Brigham Young says you get recycled. You go back to the elements and you get recycled.
Well, but you don't get it. You've chosen that.
You've chosen
relationality
that.
To where there's nothing.
It's not God that's doing this to you. You're doing it yourself.
Because you're not in a relation anymore.
Yeah. See, and then this is the difference between, and Dan was right to bring this up. My critique of Terrell's position was he was looking at Schelling and Berdyaev and these people as if they were followers of Origen. Origen's a universalist. Everybody gets into heaven whether they want to or not. For Verma and Schelling and Berdyaev, and I think for Mormons, we're not universalists in that sense. God would like to save us all, but he can't save us against our will. Remember that? Know this, that every soul is free? I can't say. God will force no one to heaven. Okay. I mean, it's there. It's in there. It's all over the place. Yeah.
Okay.
Can you come up, please?
Bob will make you do it.
It's not a question that I might need to come up and ask, but I would. This is just for Dan. I was just wondering, you know, and I may be looking at it sort of like in a simplistic way, but when you were talking about how, you know, people leaving the church and it's not the kind of church you look at, and so thinking of the opposition in all things and the hell is other people and that kind of thing, what's your opinion kind of on the structure of like ward houses and churches and like being in sacrament, like how you kind of made it sound like we sort of strive to have like a unity, but maybe it's sort of a false unity in that we view sameness as unity. So I'm just wondering how, like, you think the opposition in all things and, you know, the hell is other people getting to... Does my question even make sense?
Well,
getting
you
to
read
Zion,
a lot more than I had thought I was saying. There,
like, how do you think it should be since it's not, like you said, it's not the religion you think it is.
Well, and I guess I was trying to say our theology has become bland, and yet it's not, was really the point I was trying to make. And so I guess my thought is,
you know, if you're going to reject the Mormon God, reject the Mormon God and not some amalgamated version where you really haven't, you know, done it. As far as the structure of wards and things like that, I think they can work, and I think they do work. But they only work if you kind of come at it in that sense of what we're talking about here, of really taking advantage of this is relationship, where I not only get positive feedback, but I get the negative feedback. I get other people telling me what I'm doing wrong. And I was just sharing with Joe Geisner. We happened to have a mutual friend that he mentioned, and I was just sharing this morning with him my story of my friendship with this guy, who the very first time I met him, I was the editor of Sunstone. I was sitting on the back row of Fast and Testimony. He had been in the ward a few months, and I'd seen him as this uber nerdy, super guy. And he basically says, in this Book of Mormon DNA stuff that's out there, you know, I know the Book of Mormon's true, and all I have to say to those guys is, into the microphone at Fast and Testimony meeting. And I was telling Joe about the growth of my relationship with this guy, who somehow or other, because of his challenge to me as a person, but slowly noticing he cared about ideas or this or something, he finally, 2 years after he's in the ward, we begin to talk. Next thing we know, I'll let you know, he's volunteered at Sunstone the last 5 years. You know, this arc of thing. But anyway, it's this willingness to grow from other people. So I don't mind the way the wards are structured and stuff like that. But I do think that we can build Zion societies within our ward. And again, I love Jean England's thing that the geographical nature of the way we structure things forces you to meet with people that and learn to love people that you wouldn't otherwise love. So if that's the opposition, I'm just rambling. I really don't know what your question is. Maybe you picked up on what our question was better than me.
I guess I'm not the best
person. No. It's an important, I can feel it in the gut.
You answered my question.
Berdyaev, we didn't talk about in here, has a really nice way of putting this. He talks about two types of freedom. Freedom from, which is just the freedom from restraint. You know, that's the self, the individual. And, you know, we get in the ward, you know, you go and they look like a bunch of, you know, robots. It's the Stepford Wives, you know. But we want to be individuals. There's freedom, but the problem with too much freedom from is it becomes demonic. You know, that's what Sons of Perdition. But the other kind of freedom, he says, is freedom for, and that's to create Zion. But the problem there is, this is why the opposition in all things is important. If you put those two together, you have to have the harmony between them. You have to have the balance. You know, remember Mr. Miyagi, find the balance, Daniel-san. But the problem with the freedom for is it does tend to become totalitarian. You know, we all become the same. We can't think. You know, we just kind of robot along. So what Berdyaev says, these are two freedoms. They're both really important, but they're also two evils. One evil is the evil of too much individuality. The other evil is the evil of none at all. And that's what we have to always find the balance to. And Jean England, I remember years ago reading Peggy Stack's Journey in Sunstone, talking about the same thing. What's great about a geological, geographical war is we run into all these people. I mean, I have to get along with Cleon Skousen types.
Yeah.
I mean, I think these are the, you know, like, that's just one thing, you know, the Neanderthals got past that. but you have to get along with them. And they come over to your house and they help you move. And they, you know, they do all those things that are so much more important. Okay. So, anyway.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at, too.
But yeah, my real point was, though, that's just Mormonism is just like everybody else. But no, I mean, at least know if you're leaving us that you're leaving something.
This will be our last question.
I think.
I've got a two-part question. First is for James, and the second one is for both of you. First one, you mentioned that, I guess, God also has an opposition within him. So I guess if you could expound on that, I would like that.
Yeah.
Second is a theodicy question, I guess, relating to the idea of opposition in all things and God calling us into being, right, in that sense. Opposition in all things kind of depends on a rational faculty or character building and understanding, right, that we can learn from that. So I guess the question is, where does Mormonism see the problem of animal suffering, right, that don't have the same faculties, or even why is God calling animals into being that don't understand and yet still suffer, I guess?
Okay, yeah, it's a good question. Now, what was the first part?
Opposition in God.
Oh, yeah.
He does more in the paper with that.
The opposition goes all the way down into animals, into atoms. Okay, I mean, you can go back to Brigham Young and those guys. They'd love to talk about stuff like that. In the old days, people used to just, you know, free associate. So it's in God. What God has learned to do, why God's God, is God has learned to control it better than you and I have. And if you go to section 88 and talk, you know, it talks about the spirit and the soul and, the, you know, God, Christ becoming in and through all things. I think that's what that means.
Can I ask a follow-up question just before you say this? I guess in Mormonism, are we giving up the all-loving, in a sense?
No, that's what
ask his question.
He asks if we're giving up the all-loving. I think that's what loving is. It's like, think about this. When we look at our children, when they, you know, pop out and they're so cute, it's easy to feel love there. I think Kant called this pathological love.
but when they're being when they wake up in the middle of the night screaming, that's love. Because you go in there and you aren't feeling pathological love anymore. You aren't feeling emotional love anymore. You're thinking, I gotta love this kid. I gotta change this diaper. I gotta walk all night.
Right. I guess the question is, it's not inherent anymore.
He's got to make a choice, just like we do. He makes the choice more often. Now, the second part of the question was on animals.
Yes.
I think this makes, you know, Joseph Smith is wonderful about this. They're animal gods, okay? Everybody within their sphere doing what they can. And you know, one of the great things about Mormon heaven is I'm going to see my dog there. All of them. And my goldfish, and all those wonderful things. And they will be all, you know, everybody will achieve to the level that, and everybody will be, you know, Joseph Smith said about the celestial kingdom. It's so great, we'd kill ourselves if we could see it. And just think about that. You guys got that made. Everything after that is gravy. This is nice.
Thank you for the presentation. We're out of time. Thank you for you, Jim and Dan, and for the stimulating questions from the audience. We hope we continue to hear more from you.